Okay, I think we're on. Thank you, everyone, for coming. My name is Daniel Fox. I'm the, as of this past summer, the rabbi at Darchei Noam Glenbrook in Northbrook. And I actually came to Or Torah about 10 or 12 years ago for Torah tours. Sorry, I don't remember any of your names if you go here, but I had a great Simchas Torah here in 2007, I think. So fond memories of this shul, and it's good to be here. Thank you to the Kollel for inviting me, and thank you all for coming. I think that too often we hear a story from the Midrash or from the Gemara, something that maybe our parents told us or our teachers when we were young children. And for the rest of our lives, we remember that story or relate to it or we understand it the same way that we did when we were in second grade. You know, there are all kinds of fantastical, magical, funny, miraculous, seemingly impossible or almost ridiculous sometimes stories about talking objects and crazy things that happened. And they make good stories and they keep kids interested, but very often those stories actually contain fundamental truths and powerful, meaningful lessons and teachings that sometimes take a little bit of work to uncover, but can be very rewarding when you do. So that's what I'd like to do today, share with you one Midrash, one Gemara actually, that many of you may be familiar with already, but try to understand it on a much deeper level and show you that it actually holds what I think is perhaps the key lesson of the entire Megillah, maybe even if we can be ambitious to say the entire Purim holiday. If you go home and ask your children after a morning of learning, why was it that Vashti refused to come to the party when invited by her husband Ahasuerus? We know that, and I want to sit on this question for a moment to show you that it's the Gemara's question, but there's a lot to it. Firstly, surely I assume Vashti understood who she was dealing with. I don't care that she was his wife. She knew who Ahasuerus was, and I'm sure she was well aware that by refusing his request to come to the party, Ahasuerus wanted to show off her beauty, wanted to bring his trophy queen to show to his friends. And I'm sure that Vashti understood that by refusing to do so, the consequences would be very harsh, and they were. It's debated whether she was killed, whether she was banished. Either way, it was something that she didn't want. And I'm sure she was well aware that by saying no to Ahasuerus' request or demand, that would be the case. So what was she thinking? Why was it that she said no? And just to say that she was embarrassed or this was humiliating to her is not really enough, because the Gemara in Megillah points out that Vashti made a party for the women, but the Megillah does not say that her party was in the Beis Hanashim, in the women's area of the palace, where you would have thought that Vashti would make a women's party, but rather the Megillah says that she made the party in the Beis Hamalchus, and the Gemara says that she made it in the Beis Hamalchus, a more central area of the kingdom, of the palace, because she was actually hoping that maybe if the women's party was near the men's party, maybe she would get a little invitation and she'd get to show off a bit. It says that she was a pritza. She was somebody who enjoyed that type of frivolity and licentiousness. She was hoping, she knew what took place usually at these royal get-togethers, and she was hoping that maybe if I'm nearby, he'll think to invite me and this is what I could do. So she finds she's waiting for the invitation. This is what she wants. It's what she's hoping for. She gets the invitation. Ahasuerus sends someone and says, bring Vashti Bekeser Malchus. I want to show her in the royal crown to my friends. And as you can see in source number one, from the first chapter of Megillas Esther, Pasuk Yud Beis Vatima'ena Malka Vashti Lavo Bidvar HaMelech. Vashti refuses to come. She says no to Ahasuerus' invitation. Vayiktzof HaMelech Ma'od. Ahasuerus, as we would have predicted, is very angry. Vachamaso Barabo. His rage is burning within him. And for all intents and purposes, that's the last we hear of Vashti. So why didn't Vashti come to the party when she was invited? She was waiting for the invitation. This was her thing. It was right up her alley. She gets the invitation. Why'd she say no? So when you ask your children, or if you remember, why did Vashti say no? What do you think? Call it out. What happened to her? Why'd she change her mind? Say it, even if it sounds a little silly.
Instead of being invited directly by the king.
She what?
Through the
Oh, so she was embarrassed, but she was...
Because the queen, and she was the royalty.
Okay, but was that worth it? That she's, what happened to her next is, I would think that she would know that she'll probably lose in a fight with Ahasuerus, but maybe, okay.
Wasn't there a Medrash that said that she was invited to pop out of a cake wearing virtually nothing?
Well, correct, but what the Gemara seems to say is that's what she was hoping for. The Gemara says Vashti was a pritzta, which she liked. She was hoping that she'd get to come and show up. That's because the Megillah says Bekeser Malchus in the royal crown. So one of the Midrashim say that it was just the royal crown, but the Gemara says that. Okay, I would have thought that sounds embarrassing to me, but the Gemara assumes that for Vashti that would have been fine with it.
Did she have pimples?
Good. So that's what, yeah. So the Gemara says, and this is what you learn in second grade sometimes, but it's true. It's what the Gemara says. The Gemara actually says two possible. I remember in second grade learning, I think, that she turned green. I'm not sure if there's a source for that, but it fits along the lines. Well, yeah, maybe that's what I confused it with in second grade. Yeah. Right, yeah. But the Gemara says, if you look at source number two, Matama'in ha'malka Vashti, Vashti refused to come, michti pritzta have. Vashti was a lewd woman. So why did she say, you can't, if it was a regular woman, I would say because it was embarrassing or humiliating. You're going to show up unclothed to a party. Who would do that? But for Vashti, that was standard procedure. She was happy about it. Skipping a little bit. So my time alo asi. So why didn't she come? Two answers the Gemara gives. Amar Rabbi Yossi bar Chanina melamed sheparcha bat saras. She became a leper. Leprosy, pimples, chicken pox, whatever. Something that was so humiliating that even though this was usually her type of thing, and even though she knew the consequences would be harsh, she couldn't show up like this. Or maybe she knew if she showed up like this, the consequences might be even harsher. Hey, Achashverosh, I'm here. And embarrass him in front of all his friends, then maybe it would have been even worse. So she said, I can't show up like this. Second answer the Gemara gives, along the same lines, a different description, b'masnisa tana, in a braisa we teach differently, b'gavriel v'asa la zanav. The angel Gabriel came and put a tail on her. So she's going to show up, presumably in the royal crown and just the royal crown. And Ahasuerus is going to, you know, wants to show off proudly who he has, who, you know, his wife. And she's there with a, you know, wagging her tail. That would have been pretty embarrassing for her, pretty embarrassing for Ahasuerus. I mean, clearly the Gemara's message for both of them is something happened to her that changed her appearance in a very embarrassing way. So even though if she would have been healthy in her regular state, she would have surely gone and appeased Ahasuerus, but something happened to her that caused her to have to say no. But what I want to do, and to keep focused, is choose one of these answers. I want to really zoom on this second answer, Ba Gavriel ve'asa la zanav. Because it's a nice story, and you know, I'm sure many of your kids learned it in school. Vashti had a tail. When you read a Gemara that says that an angel came and put a tail onto a woman, that's not the answer to the question. That's the question. I mean, the Gemara says that Vashti got a tail, but you can't end the Gemara there and say, great, now we know Vashti got a tail. The next question has to be, why was Gavriel there? Why was it a tail? What is this Gemara teaching us? I'm going to put Saras on the side and the polka dots or the chicken pox. We'll have a difference here maybe on that. But why does it say that Gavriel came, and especially the tzara seemed to have come on their own. She just sprouted them out. The tail was placed on by the Malach Gavriel, by the angel Gabriel. Why Gavriel and why a tail? Yeah.
Just taking a step back, I know it's not really the direction you're going, but granted they didn't have iPhones, but wasn't there some communication that Vashti, the same messenger that said, hey, come, the king wants you to come? Can't she say, hey, look at me, I've got pimples, I got a tail?
I think that's probably what happened. It sounds like maybe I don't know when she got this tail or these chicken pox. It could be that she was in full form, she was doing great. The messengers come and say, hey, Vashti, you want to come? Ahasuerus invited you to come. Right then, Gavriel comes and puts the tail on her, and she says, now I can't. And she sends the messengers back to say she can't. And Ahasuerus, maybe a kind, sympathetic, healthy person, would say, I'm sorry this happened to you, let's go to a doctor, I'll take care of you. But Ahasuerus said, get out, I don't want to see you ever again, or maybe even worse off with your head. Why do I need a wife who has a tail? But I think that's what happened. Or maybe she grew the tail a little before, and I don't know what their relationship was like, but I don't picture Ahasuerus as a sympathetic type to sit down and listen and take care of his wife. So whenever it was she grew her tail, that was basically the end of Vashti as we know her.
There's yeah. Another question that's been bothering me for a million years.
Yeah.
And didn't Ahasuerus have his own minor league team? He had a whole harem of 1,000 women. So why did he have to go out and start looking for somebody new when all he had to do was bring somebody up to the majors?
You're saying, why did he do the whole search for Esther?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, a question, not exactly on our topic, but if that's the thing you're into, maybe it was enjoyable for him. He got to pick. He doesn't just settle for, he wants to do a search of all the women in the whole province and make a new choice. Yeah, this is his number one. The minor leaguers are the minor leaguers. He wants to find the new queen. Okay, let's see. It's a good thing this is a men's only archekala, so keep it in here. Rare opportunity. That's true. Yeah. So I want to share with you a yesod, a principle that the Gemara teaches us in a number of places, and it relates to many parts of the Torah, but specifically to the Purim story. And then I want to share two stories from the Navi and from the Gemara that I think will open up, and hopefully by the end we will have a little bit of an understanding as to why it was Gavriel and why it was a tale. Principle is as follows. Gemara says in Maseches Megillah that one of the axioms, one of the definitions of how Hashem relates to the world, and specifically relates to the Jewish people, is that, as we know, unfortunately, the Jewish people have had over the years many hardships, many difficulties. But the Gemara guarantees us that the way Hashem works is that He is always makdim refuah lemaka. That before the maka comes, before the difficulty or the potch, the plague, whatever bad thing is going to happen, before that comes, Hashem already precedes that by having the refuah, the healing, the cure, the redemption already in place. In other words, not only do we know that Hashem will save us from the difficulties, but He doesn't react after the difficulty and then swoop in and save us. But the refuah is already in place. It's already happening even before the maka begins. I don't know if this is the perfect metaphor, but I'll give you an example of what I mean. I'm just taking my phone to keep track of time. But if you've ever taken a trip to, I don't want to give an exact example or name, but to some country, let's say in Africa, where there's a certain disease that might be rampant that we're not generally exposed to here. So generally, you're supposed to get certain vaccinations before you go. Sometimes it's even required by your workplace or by your school because, okay, maybe here we don't worry that much about malaria, but if you're going to go to a country where lots of people have malaria, so you get an extra vaccination. So we've never asked, why don't you just go to the country, and chances are maybe you probably won't get malaria. If you do then you'll go to the hospital and we'll treat you. And I'm not a doctor, so what I'm saying doesn't really make sense. I'm not, don't poskin based on this. But we would never, it's what we do, we mocked him the refuah to the maka. You take the vaccination before you even expose yourself, so that even if you are exposed to malaria, and even if you do catch it a little bit, or you get a cough or a stomach ache, you can be reassured, you can be comforted by the fact that I know the medicine is already in me. I took the refuah even before I was exposed to the maka, and I will be okay, because it doesn't mean everything's going to be perfect, and I'm going to feel 100% fine the whole time, but it's the vaccination is in my blood already, before the maka was even there, and it'll protect me even if I am exposed to the maka. As opposed to risking exposing myself and then having to react and deal with it, it gets a lot more complicated. And I'm going to be worried the whole time because I'm not really prepared properly. Hashem tells us, listen, there's no guarantee that you're not going to be exposed to hardships. We went through Mitzrayim and we've gone through Crusades and Inquisitions, Holocaust. There have been terrible, terrible things that have happened. Really bad makos. But at least we know that not only will Hashem save us from all these things, but that long before they even started, before the maka even began, Hashem already knew, and Hashem already planned and had the wheels turning on how the refuah was going to happen. I'll give you two examples. When Bnei Israel go down, the family of Yaakov goes down to Mitzrayim from Eretz Canaan, before to meet their brother and their son Yosef, years before the slavery began. The Torah says that b'shivim nefesh yardu Mitzrayim, 70 people went down to Mitzrayim. And Rashi quotes the Gemara that says if you count up the actual names, we can figure out who it was. It was just one big family at the time. It actually only adds up to 69. So who was the 70th? There's a number of possible answers, but the Gemara says the 70th was one person, one baby, who didn't exist yet when they left Canaan, but was born between the walls on their way into Mitzrayim, and that person was Yocheved, Moshe's mother. Yocheved didn't leave Canaan, so only 69 people left Canaan, but she did enter Canaan, or she was carried into Canaan, presumably, as a baby. So 70 people did enter Canaan, and that's how the Gemara reconciles these numbers. And that's an example, Mefarshim say, of Makdim Refuah L'Makkah, that we couldn't even step foot into Mitzrayim, even though the slavery was years away. Slavery, we know, didn't happen until the whole family died out, Yosef and all his brothers, and then a new king came. We know the story. But we couldn't even enter Mitzrayim, enter the place where the Makkah one day would be, until the Refuah was already in motion. What was the Refuah? The Refuah was that Yocheved had to be born, the mother of Moshe. Okay, once we have Moshe, who's going to be Hashem's messenger to redeem us, his mother's there, so the Refuah's in the works. The wheels are turning. Now Hashem says, you can go, there's going to be a Makkah, but don't worry. The mother of your Redeemer is already born, the wheels of the Refuah are turning. So the Gemara says that's what happens in the Purim story. If you look in source number 3, the Gemara quotes a pasuk from the third parak of Megillas Esther. Achar ha-devari ma'ela. Pasuk continues, it says, Achar ha-devari ma'ela, gidal ha-melech Achashverosh es Haman ben Hamdasa, that Achashverosh promoted Haman to a position of authority, to a position of special importance and prominence, and that's when our troubles really, that's when the Makkah begins. Now that Haman has this power, Haman hates the Jews, and Haman hates Mordechai for not bowing down to him, that's when the Makkah really begins. So the Gemara says, Achar Dvarim Ela, Achar Mai, it's a strange phrase, Achar Dvarim Ela, after these things. Obviously after these things, we don't say every pasuk or every parak after what just happened. It's a story that flows. So why does the Megillah go out of its way to say Achar Dvarim Ela? Not only that, but the Mefarshim on the Gemara note that there's a difference between the Hebrew word Acharei and Achar. That Acharei often means like long after, meaning sometime after, but not really connected. Whereas achar implies some immediacy or direct connection. Like achar dvarim ela, right after this happened, the next step, direct connection, was what happened as follows. So, what immediately preceded Achashverosh Haman's promotion? Why is it introduced by this phrase achar dvarim ela? So the Gemara says, Amarava achar shebara hakadosh baruch hu refua lemaka. That Haman couldn't be promoted to his position of power, the Makkah couldn't begin until Hashem had the wheels turning on the Refuah. Now, what was the Refuah in this case? It was Vashti being banished or killed, opening up a space for a new queen. It was Achashverosh doing his search and eventually concluding on Esther as the queen. It was at the very end of Perek Beis, Mordechai sitting outside Achashverosh's palace and hearing Bigson and Teresh. In fact, Perek Beis, now that I think about it, this is the first pasuk I think of Perek Gimel. The last pasuk of Perek Beis says that Mordechai reported to Achashverosh what he heard from Bigson and Teresh, and it was written in the Sefer HaDivrei HaYamim, it was written in the Book of Remembrances for Achashverosh. Now that Esther's in the palace, now that Achashverosh is in, no, can't get my name straight. Now that Esther's in the palace, now that Mordechai is, imagine me on Purim. Now that Mordechai is in the Book of Remembrances, now the Refuah is already going, everyone's in motion where they need to be, now Achashverosh can promote Haman, and Haman can do his thing and pick a date and create the gallows. Little does Haman know already that the Refuah is already going, and everything he's building and planning is just going to come back and topple on him, but we'll let him have his time, we'll let the little Makkah happen. Bnei Yisrael were scared because they couldn't see the Refuah yet, but when we look back, we can see how the Refuah was already in motion before the Makkah. Now, what I'd like to do with the next few minutes is show you that the Gemara means something actually a lot deeper than this. That the refuah that took place before Haman was promoted wasn't just that Esther was chosen as the queen, that Vashti was ousted, that Esther joined the palace, that Mordechai got written in the book, but the refuah that happened before the Makkah, Hashem preceding the plague with his redemption, happened not just in Perek Beis, not just in the preceding days or weeks, but began already approximately 200 years before. So I want to tell you two stories. We're going back almost 200 years to stories that I would have never thought and I never imagined were related to the Purim story until I heard this explanation in the name of the Chafetz Chaim from my Rebbe, Rav Eli Baruch Shulman in NYU. And we'll see the depth and the beauty in what it really means that Hashem is taking care of us and looking out for us and planning our redemption long, long, long before the Makkah is even in the picture. So the story is, I'm going to say it outside on my own to save us time from reading inside, but if you'd like, at least most of the story is in source number 4. It's from Malachim Beis Perek Chaf. I'm going to interject into the story some of the Gemara's explanation of what was happening behind the scenes in this story. It's a very interesting story in its own right, but we'll see how it leads to eventually our redemption from Haman. So the story is that Chizkiyahu, a righteous Jewish king, one day at his door shows up Yeshayahu, the prophet, the righteous prophet of the times. And Yeshayahu shares with him two words that nobody ever wanted to hear from a prophet. He says, Tzav lebeisecha, which basically means get your stuff in order, you know, say your final, give your final instructions, your end is coming, you're about to die. So obviously Chizkiyahu is not very happy with this message, and the Navi says that Chizkiyahu davens and he prays. The Gemara says, this isn't in the Navi itself, but the Gemara fills in some gaps and says, why was it that Yeshayahu came to Chizkiyahu with this bad news? What did Chizkiyahu do to deserve an untimely death? He was a righteous guy. Again, not that we always understand these things, but this is Gemara's interpretation of the story. It says that Chizkiyahu had the following prophecy. He realized, he understood that he would have children, and one of his descendants would be Menashe. And Menashe would rise to be the king of Israel, and he would be a very wicked king. He would be an idol worshiper, and he would spread idol worship among Bnei Israel. He would have a very, very wicked descendant. So Chizkiyahu said, you know, is this really worth it? I'm going to have a few kids, but I'm going to bring about this terrible, evil person who's going to spread Avodah Zarah amongst Bnei Israel. Maybe it's better off I don't have any kids, and then we don't have to deal with this terrible Menashe. So he decided, I'm not going to have any children. So Yeshayahu comes and says, bad idea. The Gemara's phrase is, Yeshayahu said to him, Bahade kavshe derachman alamalach. Why are you trying to figure out Hashem's secrets? You're saying, oh, Hashem, you had a prophecy, you're going to have Menashe. Now you're going to try to outsmart Hashem and say, but if I don't have kids, then this prophecy can't come true. And you do your job. You're married, you have children, puruvu, reproduce, do the best chinuch you can, send your kids to good schools, raise them properly. And if you end up having a wicked descendant, what can you do? That, you know, that happens, unfortunately. But don't try to outsmart Hashem out and beat the system. So Chizkiyahu realizes that even though he had the right intentions, he made a mistake. So he davens. It actually says, Vayasev panav el akir. He goes up to the wall. We just learned that in Ketzer Shulchan Aruch after Shacharis a few days ago, that it's the advantage to davening next to a wall where you have a certain focus and no distraction. That's what Chizkiyahu did. He turns to the wall, he davens to Hashem, he apologizes, and he's forgiven. And Yeshayahu says to him, you're forgiven, and you got an extension on life. You get 15 more years. Very good thing. When you were just told that you're about to die, 15 more years is a good surprise. But Chizkiyahu is still a little nervous. If a prophet knocked on your door and said you're about to die, then just say, oh, never mind. He was still a little bit shaken. So Chizkiyahu wants some sort of sign. How do I know for sure that you're not going to walk out the door and I'm going to drop dead? I want some sort of guarantee that I'm actually going to, that my tshuva was accepted, that my prayers were accepted, and I'm going to live another 15 years. So Yeshayahu gives him two choices. He says, either the sun can jump ahead 10 steps, I don't know if that means 10 hours or a bunch of hours, whatever it is, the sun can move ahead supernaturally, it's 3 o'clock and all of a sudden it'll look like 7 o'clock or whatever, or the sun can move back. So Yeshayahu says, I want the sun to move back. It's probably a greater miracle because every time I look at my watch, it seems like the sun jumped ahead and the day finished. But to move back where it's like, I think it's 6 o'clock and all of a sudden it's noon, that's something much more noticeable. So Yeshayahu says, sure. So a miracle happened, the sun moved back, and it was an 18-hour day. And Chizkiyahu lived another 15 years and happily ever after. That's scene one. Still no Purim connection, but we'll get there soon. Scene two. We're now moving countries, changing people, whole different set of characters. But the important thing is that there was an 18-hour day. And moving to Bavel, to Babylonia, the king at the time was Bil-Adan. And Bil-Adan, as any good king would do, was taking a nap. If I was king, that would definitely be in my schedule. Bil-Adan had a daily nap. I don't know if he had a daily nap, but he was napping that day. And he woke up from his nap, and he thought, you know, when I was younger, there's a term like you can sleep a bagel. A bagel is when you sleep a full 12 hours, and you go to sleep at 9 o'clock, and you wake up at 9 o'clock. Bil-Adan had thought he had done a bagel and a half, because he went to sleep at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and he wakes up, and it's noon, so he thought he slept for, you know, 19 hours. And even though he's a king and he likes naps, so that's kind of embarrassing, and maybe he had things to do. He missed dinner or something. So he's very mad. He calls his servants and he says, I told you to wake me up after 2 hours. You let me sleep 19 hours. I can't believe it's 1 o'clock. It must be the next day. What's wrong with you? he's very angry. He's gonna, you know what happens when a king gets angry. So they explain to him, no. Craziest thing happened. We were going to wake you up after, you only did sleep 2 hours. But somehow in the middle of that 2 hours, the sun jumped back. It was nuts. It's like, it's still Monday, but it got earlier. So he wants to find out, like, how did this happen? Who orchestrated this? Why did the sun move back? So they do some research and they find out the story. You know, they have good information people, and they're the king, they're the royal team. So they find out that it was Chizkiah who was going to die, and he davened, and then he got a sign. He lived another 15 years, and the sign that he chose was that the sun should move back. Pretty amazing story. So Biladan says, I want to meet this guy. If there's someone who's so powerful that he requests a sign to make sure that he's going to live, and it happens, he has that close of a connection with his God that the sun actually moved back in a way that even I, the king of Babylon, can't orchestrate. I want to form an alliance with this guy. Let's invite him so that we get to know him. So the scribe at the time in Biladan's palace was, now every powerful person, I guess, begins in the mailroom. So no different than Nebuchadnezzar at the time. He was the messenger, he was a scribe, he was the mailboy who would, you know, write Biladan's letters and carry them back and forth. But for whatever reason, Nebuchadnezzar at the time also was sleeping. The Gemara doesn't say he was sleeping, but I think some of the Mefarshim, or maybe the Midrash, tells the story. It says he was also, I think he slept late that day, or he was also taking a nap or whatever. So, whatever, he had backup people. Biladan asks one of his other people to write a letter for him to greet Chizkiah after this incredible miracle. And the letter that he writes, if you look at source number 6, I'll just read a couple of lines inside. I elaborated a little bit, so if you look at the sources, and I say every detail, but more or less, that's the story as it happened. If you look in the middle, there's the English on page 3, but I'll look at the Hebrew Aramaic. It's about halfway through source 5. Anyone, what time does this year end? Sorry. But what? How much time do I have?
10 minutes.
Okay, perfect. Great. So, 5 lines into source number 5 in the middle of the line. It says, Amar Le, Mahi. This is when Biladan wakes up. He says, Mahi, like, what happened? How could it be that the sun moved back? I only slept for 2 hours, but the clock says it's 5 hours earlier, or whatever exactly the case may be. Amar Le, Mahi, what happened? So Amar Le, they said back to Biladan, the king, Chizkiyahu Chalash V'Ispach. They told him the story. Chizkiyahu was sick or was going to die, and then he got healed, and he was promised. They told him the whole story that I mentioned before. So Amar, Biladan says, Ika gavra ki hai velo bi'ina l'shadure le'shlama? There's someone this powerful, there's a man who can cause the sun to move back in the sky, and I'm not going to send him shalom. I'm not going to send him a greeting and get to know him, start a friendship, invite him to the palace. Kisvuli, write for me as follows, quote, Shalma l'malka Chizkiah, greetings to the great king Chizkiah. Shalom l'karta di Yerushalayim, greetings to the city of Jerusalem. Shalom le'elaka rabbah, and greetings to the great God. I don't know if Biladan was generally a believer in our God, but he recognized that something incredible happened here. So he's, you know, paying respects to Chizkiah, to Chizkiah's city of Jerusalem, and to Chizkiah's God. So Nebuchadnezzar, safrei de Biladan hava, Nebuchadnezzar was the scribe of Biladan, hahi shaita lo hava hasam, but at that time he wasn't there, he was elsewhere, so he missed he would have been the usual person to transcribe Chizkiyahu's transcribe Biladan's message. So Kiasa Amar Lehu Hechu Kasvisu, when he came back, when Nebuchadnezzar joined, he said, what happened? Catch me up. What did I miss? They told him the whole story. He said, what did you write? What did it say in the letter? That would have usually been my job. I wasn't here. What did it say in the letter that he sent to Chizkiyah? Amar Lehu Hechu Kasvina. So they told him exactly what the letter had said. Greetings to King Chizkiah, greetings to the city of Jerusalem, greetings to the great God. So Nebuchadnezzar says, Amar Lehu, he said to them, Karisu Le Alaka Rabba, you call him the great God, the Kasvinu Le Lebasof, but you wrote him last? As great as Chizkiah is, as great as Jerusalem is, no human being could cause the sun to move back in the sky. If you're acknowledging the fact that Chizkiah, who has some God, who has these incredible powers, why'd you put him last on the list? Greetings to Chizkiah, greetings to the city of Jerusalem. Oh yeah, and by the way, also greetings to this great God who can perform miracles that we've never seen before. It should have said, greetings to the great God. And then you can, Chizkiah and Jerusalem, you can put the other things. But how could you not put Elaka Rabbah first? This is Nebuchadnezzar saying this. Amar, Elihachi ksovu. This is what you should have written. Shalom le'elakaraba, greetings to the great God. Shalom le'karta Yerushalayim, greetings to the city of Jerusalem. Shalom le'malka Chizkiah, and greetings to the king Chizkiah. So what did they say back to Nebuchadnezzar? Great line. You can use it when you need it. Amar le'i, karyanasa de'igrisa ihu leheve farvanka. Great idea. If you want to do that idea, then you know they're already on their way. Go chase after them. It's good whenever like my kids say, like, oh, can you get the, you know, I say, Karyana Digrisa Evulay of Fanka. Great idea, you go do it. They don't understand what it means, but it's that's what they say in the Nebuchadnezzar. Yeah, you're right. Great idea. You were sleeping. You want to go do it? We already sent him on our way. We're done. We're going for lunch. You can go chase after him. So the Nebuchadnezzar feels very strongly about this. So Rahat Basre, he starts running after him. Kidurahit Arba Psios, when he took four strides. He says, oh my gosh, he already left on his way. Maybe I can catch up to him. So he starts running, and he takes four strides. Asa Gavriel, first hint, we're coming full circle. Gavriel, the angel comes, v'okme, and stops him in his place. I don't know exactly what it looked like, but somehow Nebuchadnezzar took four strides, and then it was like he hit a wall. Gavriel stopped him, and he froze, and he couldn't move anymore, and that was it. The letter got sent as it was originally written. And the Gemara says, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yochanan said, Ilmale ba Gavriel vehemido, if Gavriel had not come and stopped Nebuchadnezzar in his tracks after taking four steps, lo hayat akana lisona ehem shel Yisrael. Literally translated, it's a euphemism, literally means there would have been no hope, there would have been no fixing for the enemies of the Jewish people. What it really means is that would have been the end of the Jewish people. In other words, Nebuchadnezzar, who didn't end up being the biggest tzaddik in the world, but he was running. He was running after this, you know, the backup scribe or the mailman, because he was defending the honor of Hashem. How could you put Hashem last on the list? This was so important to him. He started running after him. And Nebuchadnezzar is being rewarded for his chasing after, literally, kavod Hashem. And if Nebuchadnezzar would have gone all the way there and swapped letters and sent a letter with more kavod to Hashem, he would have been granted such schar, such reward, such power, that he would have not only destroyed the Beis HaMikdash when he got older, but he would have destroyed the Jewish people. That would have been it. There would have been no hope left. That would have been the end of Bnei Yisrael, which is why Gavriel swooped in. Whenever I teach the Gemara, are you about to ask how this fits with free will and Bechira Chafshis?
No. If he's putting God first, why would
putting God first, oh. Maybe none of the destruction would have happened. Why is it even worse?
It's a strange thing that your reward for honoring Hashem is that you get to destroy the Jewish people. It's a funny kind of thing. We'll see a little bit more about it in a moment, but I'm not going to have a perfect answer to that question. But somehow, even the most wicked people get rewarded, and he's being rewarded apparently in the way that he wants to be rewarded. It's difficult. But somehow, if Nebuchadnezzar would have been able to finish his run, would have actually gotten to the mailman, would have swapped letters, would have been able to defend the honor of Hashem, he would have been rewarded, quote-unquote, with such great power that he would have been able to finish his ambition and knock off the Jewish people. Which is why Gavriel had to swoop in, and this, you know, usually the angels and Hashem doesn't interfere with the world in such an explicit way, but Gavriel's like, I gotta get in there, otherwise it's the end of the Jewish people, so he stops Nebuchadnezzar, he can't go anymore, and that's it, save the Jewish people.
He's like the historical protector of the Jewish people.
Gavriel is the historical protector. To make sure that we...
But Gabriel does it on his own volition. He does not send like that. Is that how that works usually?
Let's ask.
Yeah, right. I mean, usually, my limited understanding of angels is that usually they can't really make their own decisions. They are sent by God. Here it says, Ba Gavriel. It doesn't say Hashem sent Gavriel. I would imagine, though, that Hashem did send him. I mean, a malach really literally means a messenger.
Yeah,
so it's
malach can have a single purpose. Gavriel is a
Gavriel's purpose was to save the Jewish people and to make sure that we always exist. So maybe he didn't need a special instruction from Hashem, go now. He's just like, this is my thing. Whenever the Jewish people are on the brink of complete and utter destruction, I jump in and make sure it doesn't happen. So he stopped Nebuchadnezzar in his tracks. But there's one more problem. Bear with me because we're almost... I'm going to bring it back to the tail. Promise. At the tail end. Sorry. But that woke some of you up. Okay, so there's one problem. Problem is that in source number 6, it's not going to seem like a big problem, but I think it's a big problem. Source number six. I only took two lines, but it's basically the same story. It's actually the Midrash from Esther Rabbah, Parsha Gimel. The same story that I just told you about. Bil Adon and Nebuchadnezzar and sending the messenger and what the letter says and Nebuchadnezzar running after him. It says the same story again, but one small difference. Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Even before we get to this line. The small difference is that it says Nebuchadnezzar started running after he took three strides. Gavriel came and stopped him in his tracks and saved the day. Now, you know, when we learn halacha, we're so medactic about every single word. Is it three? Is it two? Is it kazayas this big or that big? Sometimes when we read stories in the Midrash, we're just like, whatever, it's a story. But if we have the same story twice, once in the Gemara and once in the Midrash, and the Gemara says he took four strides, and the Midrash says he took three strides, something's going on here. Was it three or was it four? So this is the answer that the Chafetz Chaim said. Source number six. Let's read these two lines and we'll bring it all together. Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hashem said to Nebuchadnezzar, so to speak, Ata amarata mikis echa upasata shlosh psios b'shvil kavod shemi. You got up from your chair and you ran three strides, according to the Midrash, for the honor of my name. Chayecha she'ani ma'amid mimcha. I promise you that I am going to establish for you and from you shlosha malachim sheyihu kozmakart. Torin misofa olam viad sofo. Three kings that will basically be so powerful they'll rule the world, the most powerful person in the world. Maybe that's Hashem promised Nebuchadnezzar he would be extremely powerful and he can still decide what he wants to do. Very powerful. A ruler of the world. I'm going to establish from you three kings that are going to be the rulers of the world, that are going to be the kings, the most powerful person, misofa olam viad sofo. Who were they? Ve'eluhem, number one is going to be you, Nebuchadnezzar. Number two is going to be your son, Evil Merodach. And number three is going to be Belshazzar. And we know from the book of Daniel that Belshazzar ended up, that's when the dynasty ended. That's when the family tree came to an end. Nebuchadnezzar had taken three steps. For each step, he was rewarded with one generation of a king of the world, himself, Evil Merodach, and Belshazzar. So what's this fourth step? Anyone know? Who's figured it out? Why does the Gemara say there's a fourth step? Because Belshazzar had a daughter. Belshazzar, his family, the dynasty ended, but he had a daughter. Because in the marriage between Ahasuerus and Vashti, really Vashti was the one with the royal butt. Ahasuerus was a nobody. He was a farm boy, which is why he's always nervous and killing people off. Maybe a lot of kings were like that. But Ahasuerus is always worried because he doesn't really have the royal blood. He knows he's really nothing. Vashti was the daughter of Belshazzar. And it's true, the dynasty ended after three steps, but there was actually a fourth step there, the Gemara says. It was actually, the way the Chafetz Chaim says it, is that he was mid-stride. He was in between the third and fourth step. So Belshazzar didn't have a son who was the king, but he had a daughter who was the queen, and that was Vashti. And Gavriel came and stopped Belshazzar after 3.5 steps, saying that if I let you finish this fourth stride, if Vashti lives out her life as the queen of Persia married to Ahasuerus, and they live happily ever after, that'll be the end of the Jewish people. Because guess what? Then they'll promote Haman to his position of authority, and there will be no Esther to come and stop him in his tracks. Vashti will be the king, she'll let Haman do whatever he wants, and that will be the end of the Jewish people. Gavriel said, I have to stop you mid-fourth track to make sure, yeah, Vashti can have a few years as the queen, we'll let her enjoy her time in the palace, but in the end, we're going to have to stop her in the middle. Kick her out, replace her with Esther, get the refuah in there, so that we can make sure when Haman rises to power, there's someone there to stand up against him. A zanav, in Machshava, in Jewish thought, a zanav always represents the end. When it says that Gavriel came and put a zanav onto, I don't know if she actually grew a tail or not, but what it means is that Gavriel, who had started this job already 200 years prior, when he stopped Nebuchadnezzar in his tracks between third and fourth step to say, I'll let Vashti start, but not finish, because I need to make sure I know if Vashti finishes her reign, the Jewish people will end. I'm the one who's going to have to come back and finish the job and make sure, just like I stopped Nebuchadnezzar in his tracks, I'm going to have to stop Vashti in her tracks. And he puts a tail on Vashti as to say, this is your end. You're done. Move out. Esther comes in. The refuah for the Jewish people in the Purim story didn't begin in Perek Beis, didn't begin with Vashti being kicked out of the palace or Esther marrying Ahasuerus or Mordechai getting written in the good book. That was part of it. But the refuah began 200 years before when Chizkiyahu asked for the sign that the sun should move back. And when Biladan wanted to make an alliance with Chizkiyahu, and when Nebuchadnezzar stood up and said that I'm going to go defend Hashem's honor, and when Gavriel came and said, the refuah for the Purim story begins now. Stop right here, and now we're going to start turning the wheels to make sure that in 200 years from now, when Haman rises to power, I'll put the tail on Vashti and I'll end that reign so that Esther can come in and save the day. So every year on Purim, I like to think about that we know that in every generation, there are people who try to destroy us. And sometimes they actually are pretty successful and they get to the point where it almost seems like someone, Gavriel, better come and save us, otherwise there's going to be no more Jewish people. We have had terrible makos before, but we reassure ourselves by saying that not only will Hashem come and save us every time, but long before any of our enemies were even born, long before they had any ideas of what they wanted to do to the Jewish people, the wheels are already turning on redemption. And everything they're really planning and thinking about and creating, one day, v'nahapochu, and it'll all end up coming back on them. I don't know if we'll ever see them actually grow a tail, but their time too will come when that'll be the end, and the Jewish people will live on, and hopefully, God willing, soon we'll get to see the full redemption and the full refuah and geula that Hashem has planned for many, many years, and that is already, even though we can't see it, in the works, and we'll get to see it fully realized soon. Thank you for coming. Happy Purim.
Have any of our deep Zionists